In spirit, our Sunday breakfast programme here on BBC London. So this morning we've been talking about what happens when you lose your faith. 10 years ago, businessman and entrepreneur Jeff Crocker was a well-known committed Christian, speaking at numerous Christian events worldwide. Today he is a convinced atheist, a position he believes is the only logical one in the God debate. Now, what happened? He joins us live from Bristol to tell how he changed his mind and why you might want to change yours. Good morning, Jeff.
Hello, Jimoki.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. I mean, your story is one that will be of great interest to lots of people. So let's start with what happened. You were there, you were declaring, presumably, that Jesus Christ was Lord. What changed your mind?
Yes, I was there, and that started for me at an early age of about 14, when I first began to think about religious things, and I came to a conviction that Christianity was a good view of the world, first of all because the creation needed some explanation, and secondly because human beings needed forgiveness for things that go wrong in our lives. So on that basis, I became a Christian believer, and as you say, became very intensely and deeply involved in it, speaking at conferences worldwide. I would say that my basic convictions at the time were not so much doctrinal, although I did accept the doctrine, but were more to do with the ethics and the meaning and the significance that came out of the biblical text. So there was a difference of interpretation compared to a straight doctrinal preach. So what happened? Well, I think two things. One is at a general level and one is at a specific level. At a general level, I think anybody who has any faith has to also acknowledge the presence of doubt. And there is often a very thin line between the doubt and the faith. And that's reasonable, that's fair, that's where we are all at, I think. So the general arguments about the lack of a demonstrable evidence for the existence of God, the speculations about evolution and creation, where evolution challenges creation, the issues of defective moral aspects of religious faith. So church behaviour throughout the centuries has hardly been a glowing example. In fact, on to the contrary, it's been a terrible example of lack of great value. And even in today's church, the arguments that go on and the animosity with which they're conducted are of no great credit. The issues of technology being more superior to us than any God, more determining about our life. And overall, the success of the Enlightenment project, really, where reason and logic helped us forward with medical science, with engineering and with technology, and God didn't seem to have taken any part in that process, which has become so essential to us. So those are the general things. Mm. More specifically, I found myself in a place in church life where the kind of disputes I was referring to a moment ago became so vitriolic that really it was no place of grace. I also found personally that some of the belief system started to unpick. For some people, it's about the subject of hell, where it quite easily unpicks. Mm-hmm. For me, it was on the question of forgiveness and the Christian idea that God forgives because he bashes up somebody else, i.e. his son in this case, seemed suddenly to be a very defective idea of forgiveness. You know, if I forgive, I just forgive. Mm. I don't have to go and beat somebody else up. So that became extremely troubling to me. General philosophy, I did a subsequent degree in philosophy here in Bristol, and again, the arguments there became more and more persuasive. And also people. I worked for a lot of my time in Russia, working with a lot of communists at the head of industries there, and saw that they certainly had virtue without religion.
I mean, this journey fascinates me because I am. It sounds like one which a lot of deep thought has gone into, a lot of dark nights of the soul. Even if you probably don't believe in the soul, what was the cost, though, for someone who was so forthright and so identified with Christianity? What cost was there, or has there been, to you in publicly saying, I no longer believe this?
Well, I think there is a cost in terms of the loss of some networks of friendships that were very meaningful to me. Now, some of those have faded away simply because if you don't maintain regular contact, then it tends to fade away in today's very busy world. Mm-hmm. Some of them faded away because simply people didn't want to maintain a relationship where they militantly believed and I no longer believed. So some cost there, I would guess. And I guess also a cost in saying, well, I spent a lot of my life committed to a particular interpretation. Have I actually wasted that part of my life? Now, that then started for me an attempt at a reinterpretation. And that's what the book's about, because in the book, whilst I'm setting out the reasons why somebody might come to an atheist conclusion, I'm not at all trying to persuade people of atheism. What I'm really saying is, if you happen to be there, and actually I happen to be there, does it mean an end to spirituality? And I'm saying in the book, no, it doesn't. It doesn't mean an end to spirituality, and there is still a very valid atheist interpretation of spirituality.
And this interests me greatly, because last week on the programme I had A.C. Grayling talking about his good book, which you may or may not have read. But one of the things I said to him, apart from the section where he has the thing about histories, is that the thing I miss in his book is myths, is the idea of telling the story of the world in such a way that you and I, whether we believe it or not, or whether we believe in a God or not, enables our humanity to understand the journey that we have taken more fully. And you seem to be an advocate for what you now call myths, but for some people are Christian traditions or whatever religious traditions, and you seem to be a big advocate for those.
Yes, that's what is the core of the synthesis that I'm trying to suggest in the book. Actually, I wanted to read A.C. Grayling's book, but found it was so sold out on Amazon. So I sent him a copy of mine this last week, and I hope he might send me a copy of his so that I can read it. Yeah, I think that myth is a very interesting interpretation which allows this synthesis, because what I'm saying in the book is, OK, if the doctrinal interpretation has fallen apart for you as it has for me, there is another interpretation here which allows you to keep the source of value and debate on that value and inspiration of that value. So I'm saying this is no longer becomes prescriptive. You don't have to believe A, B and C, but you can find great inspiration from those morality plays, those myths that are in the religious tradition. And I take examples like the myth of Cain and Abel and sibling rivalry significance that comes out of that. I take the myth of Christ throwing the market out of the temple and the significance of about the role of market in human life. Should there be a holy place that isn't bought and sold in human life? So I think there's a huge amount of richness there if interpreted as myth. And actually, there's almost nothing there if you try to interpret those in terms of doctrine.
Well, I'm fascinated. I've been very fortunate over the years. I've interviewed Daniel Dennett, I've interviewed A.C. Grayling, I've interviewed quite a few people who are atheists or foremost atheists, you know, around the world. And what fascinates me, and there's always a question that comes to my mind, and maybe one that you can grapple with this morning for us, Jeff, is this idea of human purpose. Because, of course, religion or faith, spirituality, gives us a sense of the reason why we are here. When you take that out of the equation, what are you left with?
I agree. I think that some of the atheist positions have become very militant, and I put Richard Dawkins in that position at the moment, and the militancy of it is leaving us with little space to be able to be creative in the way you're just suggesting. And so when you come to look at purpose, in the book I do look at this and I say, well, there's a difference between the cosmos, the universe we live in, and we ourselves as human beings. The cosmos has infinity, and we don't. We find that very hard to cope with that difference. The cosmos doesn't have any purpose written into it. It has probability written into it, actually, rather than purpose. We, on the other hand, as human beings, have a sense of purpose. Now, for the religious person, this is embodied in God and in the religious tradition. For the atheist, the purpose may be endogenous, in other words, generated from within us rather than sourced from outside of us. But actually, that's the more meaningful sense of purpose. Because even for a Christian or a believer in any other religion, if their purpose is dictated by an external source, where does that leave their humanity? Whereas for both the believer and the unbeliever, a purpose that is generated from within, a spirituality that's generated from within, I think is very valid. And I think that Christ himself actually often speaks in these terms, where he talks of rivers of living water flowing out of your innermost being. They're not from outside, they're from inside. So I think the atheist and the believer share some very common ground here.
I mean, some people will be inclined maybe towards your argument, will also be offended in a way by the idea that what they consider to be so sacred you now call myth.
Yes, well, I mean, the book doesn't seek to offend anyone, but people have to be able to develop their own thinking in an inoffensive way, which I hope I've done in the book. I am very critical of church in the middle section, and I apologise for that in advance. But it's done with tongue-in-cheek and with regard for those people. I don't think what I'm saying is to reduce something more precious to something less precious called myth, because what I do say in the book is that the word myth is often degraded in terms of its meaning, i.e. it's just a sort of flimsy story that's untrue. I think that the classical meaning of myth is it's with a capital M, with a great value, that it does represent and incorporate the great human virtues and the traditions. So I give the example of the myth in Hinduism of Rama and Sita. Interpreted as doctrine and interpreted literally, it's really very trivial. Interpreted for its meaning as a myth, it's fantastic. Mm. So actually I'm arguing that I'm raising the concept and not degrading it. And there's certainly no offence to anyone who retains their religious doctrinal views. They have access to these faith issues. I'm arguing that the atheist also has access without having to ascribe to any doctrinal belief at all.
And I am a technology freak. I'm an early adopter, as they call us. You know, any new technology, I'm there. You mentioned at the beginning of our chat that there is the part of the journey that you took was about the absence of God creating, and I paraphrase here, technology, that this is a man-made construct. Now, some people would say that the ability to create technology would have come from a God anyway. So you can't take God out of the equation, even if he or she or it was not physically involved in the upgrading of our technology.
Yes, I think that's a possible argument. So I think hypotheses sit alongside one another, and you don't necessarily have to come to a totally definitive conclusion. But I think that the evidence is that technology has solved a lot of issues which God has refused to act on. So you take the example of bubonic plague, which cruelly ravaged the populations of Europe. As you know, people died very, very painful deaths, and it hit millions. Now, God, who sets himself as a father who cares for his created people, did nothing about it whatsoever. But technology, through medical science, found the antibiotic, and we're no longer struggling with the ravages of bubonic plague. So there are quite a lot of examples where technology has enabled us, and God has stood on the sideline and, in a sense, gone AWOL in terms of any proactive care and responsibility for, quotes, his children. Mm. And the same thing happens with other technologies. I mean, today, the fact that 7 billion people live on Earth is not due to God, I think, but is due to technology. For example, without nitrate fertilizers, 40% of the population wouldn't have enough food to eat. We use contraceptive technology to prevent birth. We use fertility technology to create birth. So technology is determining lifestyles, life expectancies. We now live to 80 instead of to 30. Why? Not because of God, but because of technology. So very fundamental issues of life are technology determined and not God determined.
And I also then want to go back to the idea of the natural world. I mean, we obviously we see all sorts of things happening now, and the big events, the tsunamis, the waters and all of that that overrun the earth, it seems currently, the tornadoes, are something that we have no control over. And I want to tie that in with the idea that in some ways in the West, with our buildings and our technology and all of that, we have lost contact with nature. And we know that outside of the West, potentially, that, you know, churches and various religious organizations are seeing an increase in the influx of people who are joining their organizations. It's decreasing here generally in the West. And I wonder, and I just want you to mull over the idea that maybe we have become too removed from the natural world, and this is leading potentially to the decrease in people's belief.
I think we have become removed from the natural world. There is no doubt about that, because if we interface the natural world directly ourselves, without the help of technology, then we find, in Hobbes' words, that life is nasty, brutish and short. We live to age 35 if we're lucky. We also find that nature is red in tooth and claw. So nature and humanity, if they interact without the intermediation of technology, it's a pretty rough ride for humanity. And it's only technology that has allowed it to become a more pleasant existence for us, that has mediated the hostility of nature. And nature also, as you're intimating, has its wonderful benign elements. It has both the benign aspect and the malignant destructive element in it. So somehow or other, we need some kind of attempt to mitigate it. You use the word control, and I agree with you, I don't like that word, but somehow or other we need to find some way, if we're going to live harmoniously, to interface with nature and to change it in one degree or another. But I do also accept your point that this need for the mitigation, because without technology, humanity would be naked and a very small species on this earth, if we survived at all, actually. If we survived at all. So we do need it. We are techno-humans.
Well, Jeff, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I've been speaking to Jeff Crocker. His book is An Enlightened Philosophy: Can an Atheist Believe Anything? It's out now on O Books. Be interesting to see your thoughts once you've read the book.